We are in 2 Kings chapter 10. I realize that my time is short, so I will not try to draw this out too much, make this relatively straightforward. You're right, I did draw it out. I even have a map. Too late, I failed my own agreement, huh? 2 Kings chapter 10. Open up with a prayer if you don't mind. Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for your time, for giving us your ear and your voice. Father, please help us to listen to your voice, listen to what you wish to tell us. We will prepare and do what is fair and just in your eyes. Guard us, Father, and help us be wise. In Yeshua's name, amen. We are in 2 Kings chapter 10. Recap, those who don't recall what's going on in 2 Kings. Jehu has gone, or is the process going through, wiping out Ahab's line, his descendants. He has killed Ahab's, the king, the descendant of Ahab, Jehoram. Sorry, my name is mixed up. Jehoram has been killed along with his nephew Ahaziah. They are both being killed by Jehu and his men. And so now he's continuing on. He has also killed Jezebel as well. That was in chapter 9. So chapter 10, we're continuing on with his rampage, so to speak. 2 Kings chapter 10. Now Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. Jehu wrote scrolls and sent them to Samaria, to the officials of Jezreel, and to those who were rearing the children of Ahab, saying, "And now, when this scroll reaches you, since your master's children are with you, and with you are the chariot forces and the horses, the fortified city and weapons. See who is best and most virtuous of your master's sons. Place him upon his father's throne and fight for the sake of your master's house." They were exceedingly frightened, for they said, "Even those two kings could not stand against him. How can we stand?" So the one in charge of the household, the one in charge of the city, and the elders, and those who were rearing the children, sent to Jehu, saying, "We are your servants, and everything that you tell us we will do. We will not appoint anyone as king. Do whatever is good in your eyes." Jehu wrote to them a second scroll, saying, "If you are with me, and you wish to listen to my voice, take the heads of the male offspring of your master, and come to me at this time tomorrow to Jezreel." Now the sons of the king number 70 men, and the great men of the city are raising them. So it happened, when the scroll reached them, they took the king's sons and slaughtered the 70 men. They put their heads in kettles and sent them to Jehu to Jezreel. A messenger came and told him, saying, "They have brought the heads of the king's sons." Jehu said, "Place them in two piles at the gateway until morning." It happened in the morning that he went out and stood and said to all the people, "You are righteous. Behold, I organized a rebellion against my master and killed him. But who has struck down all of these men? Know therefore that there shall not fall unfulfilled to the earth any word of the Lord. The Lord spoke according to the house of Ahab, and the Lord has carried out all that he spoke through the hand of his servant Elijah." Jehu then struck down all those who remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all of his notables and acquaintances and priests, until he left him not a survivor. He arose and came, and then he set out for Samaria. He was at a gathering house for shepherds along the way. And Jehu encountered some relatives of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and he said, "Who are you?" They replied, "We are relatives of Ahaziah, and have come for the welfare of the sons of the king and the sons of the queen." And Jehu then said, "Capture them alive." And they captured them alive, and he slaughtered 42 men into the pit of the gathering house. He did not leave any of them alive. Jehu went on from there and encountered Jehonadab, son of Rechab. Coming toward him, he greeted him and said to him, "Is your heart sincere, as my heart is with your heart?" And Jehonadab said, it is, give me your hand." And Jehu gave him his hand and pulled up to him to the chariot. And he said, "Come with me and see my zealous vengeance for the Lord, and they drove in the chariot. Jehu arrived at Samaria and struck down all those who remained of Ahab in Samaria, until he annihilated him in accordance with the word of the Lord, which he had spoken to Elijah. Jehu then gathered together all the people and said to them, Ahab worshipped Baal just a little bit. Jehu will worship him very much. So now all the prophets of Baal and all its servants and all its priests gather them to me. Let no man be absent, for I have a great sacrifice for Baal, and anyone who is absent shall not live. Jehu was acting with cunning in order to eliminate the worshippers of Baal. Jehu said, Convoke an assembly unto Baal. And they declared it. Jehu sent messages throughout all of Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came. There was no man left who did not come. They arrived at the temple of Baal, and the temple of Baal became filled from end to end. Jehu then said to the one in charge of the wardrobes, Bring out a vestment for each of the worshippers of Baal. And he brought out vestments for each one of them. And Jehu and Jehonadab, son of Rechab, arrived at the temple of Baal, and he said to the worshippers of Baal, Search and ascertain, lest there be any among you worshippers of the Lord, for only worshippers of Baal alone may attend. They came to offer peace offerings and elevation offerings. Jehu posted 80 of his men outside and said, If any one of these men whom I am putting under your charge escapes, your soul shall be in place of his soul. It happened when he finished performing the elevation offering service that Jehu said to the runners and the captains, Come, strike them down. Let no man get away. And they struck them down by the sword. The runners and the captains threw themselves onward, and they advanced going into the city of the temple of Baal. They removed the monuments of the temple of Baal and burned them. They smashed the pillar of Baal, and they demolished the temple of Baal and designated it for latrines until today. Thus Jehu eliminated the Baal from Israel. But regarding the sins of Jeroboam and the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin, the golden calves, that were in Bethel and Dan, Jehu did not turn away from them. The Lord said to Jehu, Because you have done well doing that which is proper in my eyes, for you have done the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, four generations of your descendants will sit on the throne of Israel for your sake. But Jehu did not watch to follow the Torah of the Lord, God of Israel, with all of his heart. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam that he caused Israel to sin. In those days, the Lord began to cut away Israel. Hazael struck at them along the entire border of Israel from the Jordan toward the rising sun. All the land of Gilead, of the Gadites, the Reubenites, and Manasseh, from Aroer, which is on the Arnon Brook, to Gilead and Bashan. The rest of the deeds of Jehu and all that he did and all of his might, behold, they are recorded in the book of Chronicles, the kings of Israel. Jehu lay with his forefathers, and they buried him in Samaria. His son, Jehoahaz reigned in his place. The days Jehu ruled over Israel were 28 years in Samaria. That was 2 Kings chapter 10. Any questions or comments? Yes, Dan. Jehu been killed too? Explain.
Well, because it says he didn't
turn away from all. Right. He failed. He turned away the sins from Baal, but not from Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which created the calves. There's a calf down here, roughly on Shechem, and one up here on Dan, that area. Or Bethel, I think. Sorry, Bethel and Dan. Those two, the two calves where they're located at. He did not get rid of those. What does that mean? What were those calves doing? Do you guys recall what Jeroboam did with those calves? What did he do with them? What did he tell them? He offered offerings to them and various other things, but he told the people of Israel, the northern tribes, something very specific about those calves. What were they? What did he claim they were? They were the same God that you use, Yahuwah, or whatever he would call them. He called them that name. This is Israel. This is your God. Much like, think back to Moses and Aaron and the golden calf. He was saying, this is it. This is the same God, the same idol. What got Ahab in more trouble than Jeroboam, although he was similar to him, as Ahab imported a second one, known as Baal, a second god, from up north, via his wife, and brought Baal from up north, a god from there, down into Israel, which wasn't there before. So Jehu, all of his work that he did, the cleansing he did, he wiped away one of the gods, Baal, but did not wipe away the calves. Not Baal, the calves. The calves are different than Baal. Baal is I described this a few times in the past. There's Asherah, and there's Baal, and then of course they have their son. So the king, the Baal is a type of king worship, but it's the male version of a god, and of course he has his wife, the Asherah. So that male version of the god was wiped out. Now Jezebel's specialty was the Asherah side. She was more of the female side of it. That's where she her details noted. Did it describe any of the removal of Asherah? No, I didn't hear that either. Which means, what's still around?
The poles.
The poles are still around. The high place of Asherah, I'll abbreviate because I never spell it correctly each time, is still around. So those haven't gone away, nor have the calves, the idol calves, gone away. So those are still around too. So how good of a job did Jehu do cleansing? Yes, Tammy.
Mediocre at best.
Mediocre at best.
But this explains some of the archaeological evidence you see all over the land of Israel, from Bethel to Dan, so to speak, is that you will see, when they dig up from this time period and later on, is you'll see statues or you'll see plaques that talk about, you know, God and his Asherah.
Right.
So basically all he did was replace Baal with God. And
right.
Then Asherah became God's wife instead of Baal's wife.
Exactly.
That's all he did.
It's like swapping identities.
Yeah.
Woohoo. Yeah, mediocre at best is a good description. He didn't do a very good job. He did a very poor job. So what was his reward? Well, he got a third of the job cleansed, which is not, I guess, what that's still an F. The F is 50%, right? So he's at 33%. 33% of the job was done, and so he got rewarded with only four generations. Four generations of kings of his line, including himself, will reign as Israel. After that, they're gone. That was his reward for doing a third of the job. Now, contrast that, of course, to David. What was his reward? Everlasting. So he did a much better job. He did not do a very good job. Now, point out here in verse 31. And Jehu did not watch to follow the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. This is verse 31. And he did not turn away from the son of Jeroboam that he caused him to sin. So, as Tammy correctly pointed out, he basically just swapped identity. So Baal is officially gone, but now you still have the same pagan fake gods are still around, and they're still worshipped, which means the fake holy days that Jeroboam created were probably still being done. Which is that he just postponed all the holy days by a full month. So they're still being done to these pagan gods, and Asherah's still hanging around, and anything associated with her is still hanging around, or it, I shouldn't say her, it is still hanging around. So none of that stuff got cleansed up. I will not say this was God's best attempt at cleaning up Israel, but I will say it's one of his last. And so at the end of the chapter, you'll notice, what does it say that God decides to do in verse 32? In those days, the Lord began to cut away at Israel. Cut away at Israel, Hazael struck them along the entire border of Israel, from Jordan to the rising sun. So basically this whole region, from Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, including Ramoth-Gilead, were all being struck. Because Aram, by the way, Aram is Hazael, that's his kingdom. Aram at Assyria, we call it today. So he was taking out chunks. We don't know what size chunks were. Now, they already owned Ramoth-Gilead, so they probably took out huge amounts. So pieces were being taken. It was doing raiding parties, taken from the Jordan River, from here, all the way to the rising sun. So it means all this region, Hazael, was taking. Bit by bit, chunk by chunk. Piece by piece. In a manner of speaking, if I were to look at this, my mind would say, God's giving up on them. I've tried to cleanse up northern Israel. I've sent Elijah. I sent Elisha. I sent many other prophets. I've sent messages to you over and over and over again. I've been compassionate in timing with regards to Ahab, given him abundance of times to return. I even gave his son a little bit of time to return. Jehu was the, quote, best, quote, person to choose to rule Israel, and he only did a mediocre job. If I was looking at this, I'd say, yeah, God's saying, Israel, you're done. So your days are numbered. Now, of course, they're numbered, but they still have about 100 years plus to go before they're actually wiped away. But still, the process has begun. So God has started his effort of cleansing, meaning removal, of the northern tribes. Any questions or comments so far? Yes.
But, so you know the idea that there are principalities over areas?
Right.
Spiritual principalities?
Mm-hmm.
So if he left Asherah, would they have authority over those principalities? Or over those areas? They were left, those spiritual principalities were kept intact, right?
As if the principality that's associated with Asherah was in control of Israel, so to speak.
Yeah, they weren't wiped out, so they had authority.
I've heard that theory before, and I can't say anything's right or wrong about it necessarily. However, I will say this, which is probably a wrong application, but I'm saying it anyway. When time came for Judah to be captured and carried away, by Nebuchadnezzar and off into Babylon and such, God went with them, with those people. Not all of them. But he went with them. You were Daniel and such, and there was Mordecai and Esther. There's people, God was still with them. So, in that instance, they were in a, quote, pagan territory, ruled by a pagan principality. No influence per se by the God of Israel, meaning the principality of Israel. But yet, clearly, God still went with them. He still communicated, talked back and forth. We do realize a story about the vision of the angels and such. Those details still occurred. In the case of Baal and Asherah, those are usually associated with idols, the concept of it. But I do also realize that demons do associate with idols too. So it's a hairy thing for me to say for certain whether there was some other demon influence that was still in control of people at the time, which that's what we have. Principality of the air is a type of a demonic influence. I won't say for certain that's what was or wasn't happening. However, these people up here, in other words, were considered or compared to whores. Well, what is a whore's heart? Split to every one of her individual lovers, right? So one could argue that God may have been in there, meaning amongst some of the people of Israel, but most of the people in Israel were not after him. They were after the whores of their heart, going after whatever lover they could find. And that's, I would imply that's probably what's going on. And that they desired other gods, not the one God. So in which case, the theory of Asherah being associated with a god or principality that was in charge, it could be, but I won't say it is, because I don't know. Clearly, God can move around whenever he wants. What the other principalities do, it's hard to say what they can and can't do, what their limitations are. Wait, the comment? Oh, okay. Yes, Carrie.
Not necessarily to say either way. But it seems to me that God gave Jehu a specific task. And if he didn't think that Jehu could accomplish it, he wouldn't have given it to him.
He'd give it to someone else.
You know, Jehu did a half job. You know, so that inherently means he was capable of more.
Mm-hmm. You're right. He was capable of more. He chose to stop himself at that point as opposed to keep going. Yes, Summer.
This is kind of like a question. When it says, "Do not put in your lips the name of the gods," is that supposed to mean that we're not supposed to speak to them or like worship them? I know we're not.
Yeah,
supposed to worship
I get myself in trouble with this particular question you're bringing up. So I'll hesitate to answer it the way I normally do. I'm partially pass on it, just partially. I use names of these because I'm reading the text and describing who is what and what is what. There are some individuals who choose to spell the names only with letters. And that may be fine for them too. When I read the text and it says, do not have the word names for the gods. It is designed to do not consider them a actual deity or thing to worship or to honor. To have no respect to them. They're just pieces of object in my definition here. Names. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, because that goes to something that the Apostle Paul talked about, you know, with the so-called powers and
right.
false gods and such. It's like they have no power in and of themselves except what God decides to give them for whatever task he gives them.
Right.
So it goes back to your topic of the principalities. That comes up with, in the book of Job, when all these folks are crying out to their regional deities and such. But, Job was way far away from Israel at that point in time.
Yes, and God was still with him, right.
Exactly, because God is over all, the
right.
King of kings, Lord of lords, and
right.
there is over any sort of thing that may be called a deity or a mm-hmm. power or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Which, along those lines, it implies that whether I am located here, whether I'm located over there, whether I'm located in the jungles of a miserable place with nothing but, pagans all around me and, human sacrifice, whatever, God's still there. And I can still say, no, I'm not doing this. So that's the whole point, that whether or not the deity or principality associated with Asherah or any other god, to use the term very, very loosely, man-named god or power, is around or not, is independent of what the people do. It's completely independent. They have the choice to make the decision. I'm going to do this, so I'm going to do that. Truth is still always there. There's a lady named, Darya Efimov? Efimov? Oh, I always mispronounce her last name. She's a Russian lady. Many years ago. Bolshevik Revolution. She goes through her story and discusses, she's killed during the revolution, but goes through her story and discusses, and she has the opportunity to actually speak to the man who's trying to kill her, or about to kill her. And she spends an hour telling him what is true. Couldn't care less what the man had power over her. He just signed the paperwork and she's dead. He's in charge. And she spent an hour telling him what is actually true and just and kind and fair. And it saved her life. He decided not to kill her. That tells me that even though in a dark place where you have no options, that God is still with you and you choose to do what is right. Doesn't always mean you come out at the end alive and healthy. She dies later. But at least that moment in time, she made a choice to do what she knew was right. Just to declare what is true. And that's true no matter where you're at. Whether you're in, Samaria back in Ahab's time with, Elijah running around all by himself, or whether anywhere else, makes a difference. To always know what is true and declare what is true, God will be with you there. But anyway, sorry, that's off on tangent. Where was I? Okay, so we know what's going on here in the map, right? As far as who's being captured, Hazael is taking these regions chunk by chunk. And I'm not going to discuss every detail of all of the battles he goes through. The Bible doesn't give us that much information. But let's continue on, though. Excuse me. So Ahab, of course, has 70 sons, which does not necessarily mean firstborn or first children. It could be grandchildren. The Bible is very loose when it says son or grandson. They're interchangeable. Much like it does with daughter or granddaughter. It's interchangeable. It doesn't discuss whether it's your first or, a subsequent child. That is evident, obviously, if you can see it in chapter 11, when it talks about Athaliah. And Ahaziah's mother and what happens to her and that who she is and what her descendancy is, that she's identified as being a child of someone, which actually is a granddaughter, they use daughter and granddaughter, son and grandson interchangeable. So these 70 sons may not necessarily be the immediate sons of Ahab. They may be grandchildren involved or even great grandchildren could be there as well. So these could be like little kids could be included in these 70 men. So Jehu has gone or traveled. He's going back and forth from Jezreel to Samaria, messenger wise. I'll erase some of this stuff because I don't need all this detail up here. Forgive me. Erase this stuff and that off my map. So he's going back and forth, messengers, scrolls, back and forth, Jezreel, Samaria. We don't know precisely where Jehu's personal house happens to be, but he seems to be dwelling in Jezreel a lot. In this, was it verse 4? Oh, sorry, no, in verse... this is verse 1, actually. He writes scrolls. Who does he send the scrolls to? He says, in verse 1, he sends them to Samaria, to the elder officials of Jezreel, and to those who were rearing the children of Ahab. But of course, so he's calling out all the descendants that of the men of for Ahab from Samaria, as well as Jezreel, and wherever the other people surrounding are. Now, he's hanging out in Jezreel. So we'll put Jehu over here, a little circle around his name. That's where he's hanging out. That's where he is. I have a question for you. Where is his army? And remember? Sleeping? Who do you recall in chapter 9 when Jehu is traveling from Ramoth-Gilead to Jezreel to kill Jehoram? Who's with him? Well, there's him. There's a few of his immediate officers. And that's it. What did he command his army to? He told the few officers remaining and his army to stay at Ramoth-Gilead. At least any information come out or any people come out. So his army is hanging out here. So he's over here with himself, his chariot, and a few other chariots probably with him. That's it. How many men? Well, probably a handful, maybe two. Or maybe ten, give or take. Hard to say the exact numbers. And he was able to kill two men, Jehoram and Ahaziah here. Both those men were killed. They were not assisted by anyone. There was no massive army with them. There were just two kings. So he's traveling to Samaria, and he messaged to Samaria, as well as to Jezreel, as well as any other descendants, men who were taking care of Ahab's sons. He points out in verse 2, you have with you your master's children, which means all of Ahab's descendants, the chariot forces and the horses associated to each city, by the way. Each city has their own small standing army given with them. So Jezreel and Samaria are not on Jehu's side. They're not yet. They will be, but they're not yet. He's still opposing them. They're still opposing him. He was able to go through Jezreel, obviously, and kill Jezebel. But he didn't get to take the city. I mean, the city did not throw their support behind him. As far as they're concerned, he just regicided. He just killed his king, killed his master. That's all he did. He has done anything else. There's a reason why he was compared to Zimri. And remember what the story with Zimri was? Jezebel compared Jehu to Zimri when he first showed up to Jezreel. Zimri was a man who was before Omri. he killed the king of Israel. And he was king for, I think it was 7 days. Before he killed himself, or was killed, hard to say, in a big massive fire that burned the palace down because Omri, the commander, was coming to take over and kill him off for killing the king. And Omri then, of course, becomes king, who is the father of Ahab. So, he's being compared, Jehu's being compared to Zimri, or he was compared to Zimri. So as far as Jezebel's concerned, and anybody else in Jezreel that agreed with her, he's nothing more than hoodlum. A rebel. Jehu's considered the same as him. So they're both hoodlums. They're worthless men. Not of value to anyone. Anybody who believes or agrees with Jezebel or Ahab are on their side, he is nothing more than one man with a few of his friends. They're trying to start a rebellion. Easily squashed. So he's sending off a challenge to Jezreel and Samaria, to these men. They have chariots, they've got horses that's assigned to each individual city, independent of the army still at Ramoth-Gilead, to come out and fight. There's obviously other descendants of Ahab still alive to come forward. And what is their excuse? Verse 4. They're exceedingly frightened, for they said, even those two kings could not stand against him. How can we stand? Why do I say that that is an excuse? Why would you think that would be an excuse? Meaning not a reason, rather a fake reason. They are cowards. That's what they're doing. If they've got 70 men, varying age, and any of the other supporters in either city, do they outnumber Jehu?
Yeah.
By a lot. Not by a little bit. By a whole lot. Samaria is the capital city. It still has the royal guard in it. Jezreel is Ahab's personal town, practically. It also has the royal guard still in it. So any king or message from Samaria, if it ever reached Jezreel, assuming it could, can gather together and muster up an army to attack Jehu in his small number of chariots. They're petrified of him because he was able to kill two individual men. They're scared of him. Why would that be? You're right. Sometimes it is. But there's something else going on here, religious-wise. He is. Do you recall, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, what is Baal worship? It's false god of false king worship. So Baal is a type of king worship. Just like Asherah is a type of queen worship. So this man just killed their god. If you truly believe and honor the Baal system, this man has just killed their new god, the king. So it's not that he just killed a man, as we would look at it. He killed a man. So what? There's a whole bunch of men who were killed. Anybody can do that. It's that they're petrified or scared they killed a specific type of man. The one they're supposed to be honoring as a type of God. Or considering a God here in person form. That's what they're supposed to be doing. So, they're not just afraid of a man, Jehu, killing men. They're afraid that Jehu killed a king, and not only one king, the other king of Judah at the same time too. So they killed them both. That's what they're afraid of. It's bigger than just, he killed a man. He killed a god, as far as they're concerned. So they have a different reason to be scared than just he happened to kill a man. So they put, behold, they could not keep, these two kings could not be stand against him. How can we stand? So of course they agreed. They capitulated. They agreed to do whatever he told them. Of course the messenger's out and they kill the men. In verse 7. It says they reached, the scrolls reached them, they took the king's sons, they slaughtered them, the 70 men, they put their heads in kettles, and they sent them to Jezreel. Now, what was the instruction by Jehu? In verse 6, that if you're with me, to listen to my voice, take the heads of your master's offspring, come to me at this time tomorrow to Jezreel. Did any of the elders come to him? No. Verse 7, it points out, they sent the heads. Now that verse 8, a messenger was one who had to tell him. Again, it's a cowardice, but it's something very specific type of cowardice. Jehu's playing the leaders of Jezreel and Samaria against the people of Israel. He does that in the following verse. Jehu is playing the leaders of Samaria and Jezreel against the people of Israel. By then not showing up, he was able to point something out to the rest of the people of Israel, in particular when he addresses Jezreel in verse 9 and 10. So the messenger tells him, they brought the heads, he says, place them in two piles at the gateway until morning, the gateway of Jezreel. So he's right in front of Jezreel at the gateway. It happens in the morning, verse 9. He went out, well, goes out, stands in front of the people, you are righteous. Behold, I organized a rebellion against my master and killed him. But who has struck down these men? What is he pointing out, the people of Jezreel? These men, the people of Jezreel, who are not supporting Jehu, are listening to this. What is it that they are seeing or hearing from him? Actually, they are righteous, actually, what he calls out. He points out the righteous as well. One of the details he says there is that when he says, I killed my master, which is, I killed one man. Who killed these 70? Now, all the people of Jezreel know who these 70 heads belong to. So who killed them? No. He's asking them a legit question. What human killed them? What humans killed them? Did Jehu do it? No. The households that know who are the households, your leadership. For Jezreel and Samaria, the leaders are the ones who actually killed the 70 men. What was that? It's the government. The government. Yeah, the government did it. The leader's the ones who did it, not Jehu. Now Jehu, oh, hey, you would have been, go ahead and do it, but they're the ones who actually did it. They could have said no. They're the ones who did it. So he's pointing out to the citizens of Jezreel that your own leaders are now murderers or supporters of me. You're murderers of your king, you're murderers of your master, you're supporters of me. He just legitimized himself as the heir, or the new king of the throne, pointing out that your leaders have just shown and thrown their hat in the ring, so to speak, on my side. So any of you who disagree with me, think I'm some kind of just a rebel that's out there to kill one man or try to take the throne, I now have the support of your masters. Just legitimize himself. This is really important for him. Because Jonadab is going to show up on the scene real quick, and he's a very important man. So Jehu legitimizes himself by this act, and these leaders are so cowardice, they did not show up. So they cannot refute his point or say, well, but you know, whatever, blah, 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 give me some lame excuse. So the leadership has now thrown their support behind Jehu, and Jehu points it out to the people. But in verse 9 it says, you are righteous. Who is he addressing? Verse 9, sorry, when he talks to people, the first sentence is, you are righteous. Who is he saying is righteous? He's addressing Jezreel. He's standing at the Jezreel gate, or near the gates of Jezreel. Who is he addressing? It says, verse 9 says, went out and he stood and he said to all the people, you are righteous. Behold, I was rebellious master who killed these 70. So he's addressing the people of Jezreel, not just the citizenry, but also the leadership too, because who's at the gates? City of the gate? An important people are at the gates of the city. They're the ones who assess, you know, what the city's doing. It's like a government. The government is the gate of the city. So when he's at the gate of the city, he's putting his 70 heads, he's addressing the people of Jezreel specifically. However, the government is the one who he's looking at, because it's the gate of the city. They're the ones looking at appearing. He's pointing out to them that the king is now dead. All of his descendants are now dead. Only one is by my hand, the rest are by your. But you are all righteous. I mean, this isn't murder, which is bizarre. Have you ever heard, you know what murder is, right? You know, you kill someone. No. He's pointing out this is not murder. How can he say that? How can he say this isn't murder? This is what God commanded to have happen. And everyone in Jezreel knows it. So here you want, and he explains what he's talking about in verse 10. Know therefore that there shall not fall unfulfilled to the earth any word of the Lord. The Lord spoke concerning the house of Ahab. The Lord has carried out all that he's spoken through the hand of his servant Elijah. So he's pointing out to them that not only am I the legitimate king, because even your leadership agrees with me, this killing of all these men is not defined as murder in your eyes, because God said these men should all be killed in this fashion. They could argue, oh, but he's just making it up. How can he know that God's on his side? Which is a legit question. But that's what he's pointing out to Jezreel, the people of Jezreel. So he's claiming rightful heir to rightful throne, not somebody heir, sorry, the right to the throne, as well as the leadership being on his side, and you knew people of Jezreel, you're not guilty of anything, doing anything wrong. So you're absolved from any murder or any kind of libel for this act of killing any of the sons of Ahab. I wonder if I said yet. Sorry, we're getting to something that's very important. I'm trying to get there quickly. I'm already out of time. I started out of time, though, so that's not fair. Once this is done, once he's completed this addressing of Jezreel, what is he then allowed to go do in verse 11? He struck all those that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, all of his notables, acquaintances, priests, until he left not a survivor. So after he addresses Jezreel and all the people in it, it says, this was a righteous act, meaning God commanded this act. Now, mind you, there are not many men with him right now. He still has most of his army still at Ramoth Gilead. All this is happening within like a day or two. This is a very short period of time. So he's addressing all these men. This is what's going on. None of you are guilty for this. I am the rightful king. Exactly. And they won't stop him. They won't say, no, we're going to protect, which is what his objective was. Get the people involved. It's brilliant. He's a really smart individual. The guy's really smart. Too bad he didn't finish the job, but he's smart. So he's getting the people involved. He's now obviously cleansed Jezreel of the whole detail of what's going on. And he moves on from there. Once Jezreel's finished, he takes off obviously not just Ahab's descendants, but all of his notables and his acquaintances and his priests. What priests would that be? The Baal priests. This comes up later because it's really bizarre. So Baal priests in Jezreel are killed.
What verse is that?
This is verse 11. Sorry. And finish off verse 11 and go into verse 12. So Baal priests are all killed in Jezreel. Now, which again, it makes you question the intelligence of the Baal priests. So he moves on to verse 12. He heads out for Samaria. There's a gathering house. It doesn't say where it is. It's somewhere between Jezreel and Samaria. With a relative Ahaziah there, he kills them. Yeah, you're going to go through all that story there. What do I get to is verse 15. I'm going to erase some space because I need some more space, so forgive me. Oh, the question's gone. Oh, no. All right. So verse 15. Who's he meet? Yep. Rahab. Let's misspell it. Who is that? Who is Jehonadab, son of Rahab? Is he a good man or a bad man? You should at least figure that much of the story. Is Jehonadab on God's side, or is he on anybody else's side? Jehu up there on my little diagram thing I was drawing up. He's far better than Jehu, by extremes. Which should bring this question that Tammy brought up a few minutes ago. That I think it was Tammy brought up. Somebody did. Was that Jehu was selected to this particular task. He was assigned to do it. So obviously he could do it. He didn't finish the job, but he could have if he chose to. He chose not to. It makes you question, why didn't God choose Jehonadab to do the task? Because he was far, far better. Let's read Jeremiah chapter 35. Read something about this man. Jeremiah chapter 35. A little bit about this man and the influence he wielded in Israel. How important of a person he was. Jeremiah chapter 35. Now, mind you, this is written almost 200 and not quite 250 years later. So 250 years go by, roughly, between the events of Jehu and this event recorded in Jeremiah 35. The word came to Jeremiah from the Lord during the days of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, go to the house of the Rechavites. This is Rechav. I mean, the son of Rechav, this is the house. And speak them, bring them to the temple of the Lord, to one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink. This is the temple of the real God, our God that we know of God. The temple of Yahuwah, how you pronounce it, that's the temple he's bringing to. This is in Jerusalem. This is occurring inside the city of Jerusalem. This is occurring in the southern tribes, obviously not in Israel. This is almost 250 years later. I'm starting in verse 1. Just finished verse 2. Yeah, command them to give them wine to drink. So I, verse 3, took... forgive me if I pronounced the guy's name wrong. To Hazaniah, son of Jeremiah, son of Habazaniah, thank you. And his brothers, and all of his sons, the entire house, the Rechavites. I brought them to the temple of the Lord, to the chamber of the sons of Hanan, son of Igdaliah, the man of God, which is next the chamber of the officers, which is above the chamber of Maaseh, son of Shalom, the gatekeeper. Before the members of the house of Rechavites, I placed drinking bowls full of wine and cups. And I said to them, drink wine. They said, we do not drink wine. For Jehonadab, son of Rechav, the guy that we're dealing with Jehu, our ancestor commanded us, saying, you shall not drink wine, you nor your descendants forever. And a house you shall never build. Seeds you will never sow. A vineyard you will never plant. Nor shall there be any kind for your ownership. Rather, you will live in tents all your days, that you may live many years on the land which you sojourn. Nope. This is, we're learning about this man and his family. Verse 8. We heeded the voice of Jehonadab, son of Rechab, our ancestor, according to all that he commanded us, not to drink wine all of our days, we, our wives, our sons, and our daughters, and to not build houses as our dwellings. And there will not be a vineyard or field or seed for us. Rather, we live in tents. For we hearkened and acted according to everything that Jehonadab, our ancestor, commanded us. But, however, it happened when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylonia, attacked the land. We said, come, let us run to Jerusalem, because the army of the Chaldeans and because the army of Aram. And we settled in Jerusalem. They take their family, a very specific family, but it's what their actions matter, not their generation, their actions, what they do. Because what this man did in Jehu's time and what his descendants did is what mattered, that's what we're discussing today. Jeremiah chapter 35. I just read through verse 1 through 11. Thank you. Jeremiah chapter 35. I just read 1 through 11. A little confusing there, huh? We're not done yet, though. I'm going to finish this chapter. The word Lord then came to Jeremiah, saying, thus says the Lord, Master of Legions, the God of Israel, go and say to the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, will you not learn a lesson to listen to my words? The word of the Lord. Upheld were the words of Jehonadab, son of Rechab, who commanded his children not to drink wine, and they have not drunk wine to this day, for they obey the commandment of their ancestor. Yet I've spoken to you, arising early and speaking, and you have not listened to me. I sent all my servants and prophets, rising early and sending them, saying, repent now, each of you, from his evil ways, improve your deeds. Do not go after the gods of others to worship them, so that you may settle upon the land that I have given you and your forefathers. But you did not incline your ear, and you did not listen to me. Verse 16. For the children of Jehonadab, son of Rechab, have upheld the word of their ancestor, that he commanded them, but this people have not listened to me. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of legions, the God of Israel, behold, I am bringing to Judah and to all the inhabitants of Jerusalem all the evil that I have spoken concerning them, because I spoke to them and they did not listen, and I called out them, but they would not answer. And the house of Rechabites, Jeremiah said, thus says the Lord, Master of legions, the God of Israel, because you have heeded the commandment of your ancestor Jehonadab, and you have kept all his commandments, and have done according to all that he commanded you. Therefore, thus says the Lord, Master of legions, God of Israel, there will not be cut off from Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, a man who stands before me all of the days forever. Jehonadab, go ahead. What's your question?
Because they obeyed an ancestor instead of Elohim, correct?
No, not quite. If you look at the verse, verse 5. Before the members of the house of the Rechabites, this is Jeremiah speaking, placed drinking bowls full of wine and cups, I said to them, drink wine. Let me repeat that one more time, the last, six words. And I said to them, drink wine. Now, he does not say, the Lord demands you or declares to you, drink wine. He said, I, Jeremiah, am telling you to drink wine. So, it wasn't a command of God to make them drink wine. God was proving a point that these individuals are willing to listen to a man who's been dead for 200 plus years, who told them one time, or at least at once, don't do these list of things, and they wouldn't do it. That was the point. That's what God's trying to point out to them. Even now, in the temple, hold on, now in the temple, the holy place, the bread of all things, where wine is, flows freely, and God's here, it was supposed to be here, all the various officials are there, this is a normal place to do it. If you give them wine, they still won't do it. Because they listened to one man a long time ago. But yet, Judah, all of Jerusalem, you guys won't listen to God. You know, I tell you many, many times. That was the point of Jeremiah 35. That these men listened to their ancestor a long time ago, who's long since been dead, could not repeat himself. I repeat myself over and over and over again, and you ignore me. But these men are more righteous than you are because they listened, not that they listened to God or not good, listened to God. In fact, they listened to someone who gave them a message even once, and they stuck with it. That was the point. So what does that tell you about Jehonadab and his descendants, of course? But the man himself, he understood something. He understood something of what was truly valuable. So, does he understand who God is? Jehonadab, did he know who God was? I'd have to say yes, he did. Because he did, for lack of a better term, a trick. It's a brilliant trick. I like this man. He's one of my favorite people in the whole Bible. No, 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 no. That was Jeremiah's job. What, Jehonadab, what did he command him to do? What happens when you don't own land?
You can go.
You can go. What happens when you don't own a house? What happens when you don't live with properties of your trees and bushes and crops and everything else? You go hungry. You're not responsible for any of it. You live in tents, you have animals. That is your ownership. That's what you have. You're mobile. What happens when you don't drink wine ever?
You stay sober.
You stay sober all the time. As we learned in Leviticus 10, I think it's 10. Don't drink before God. Don't drink when you go to God. So your mind stays clear what's clean, what's holy, what's not holy. So you know the difference. Jonadab commanded all of his descendants to do something. Not drink, not to keep themselves separate, clean, individual, separate. They were separated. He's a brilliant man. Don't know how that was. Whether he knew it or not, he was very brilliant. Because, any of you recall what the problem that God was so angry at Judah with, where it lasted 70 years for exile? What specifically was it that he said the 70 years was from? They were not keeping the Shemitah. They were not resting the land. Do Jonadab and his descendants, do they own land? Do they have any land to ever have rest? No. Can they ever be accused of never letting their land rest? No. Are they then for exempt from that law? Yeah. They are. That was brilliant. Now, don't get me wrong. They're not exempt from the debt issue. That's a separate problem. But regarding the resting of the land, they don't have that. They're not guilty of that. And was God pleased with them? Well, look at chapter 35 of Jeremiah. He seems pretty pleased to me. Forever. You will never have descendants, at least this not before, to descend for you. Forever. That's the last verse of 35, verse 19. Forever. So God was pleased with them, yet he was infuriated with Judah and Israel. So Jehonadab, whether he knew it or not, by requiring his descendants to be nomads, essentially, what they're being, they were insulated from making the mistakes that all of Israel, all of Judah, kept making over and over and over again. Essentially, yeah. And God was not upset with them. He did a good job. He was smart. And they listened. And they listened. So, Jehonadab's a really important man in the time of Jehu. Yes. Yeah.
So what's going
to
happen now?
Well, you know, what happens to the rest of Jeremiah and Nebuchadnezzar and when he comes through again, we'll discuss that later. Because that's for a different prophet for a couple of hundred years to go down the line. We're discussing that detail. My point was to bring that up to you was that to identify who Jehonadab was, how well revered he was by his descendants, and what he commanded them to do, and how, in my mind, brilliant he was in doing it. because he knew God well enough to have done this much, I think he probably did know what he was doing when he commanded them to never sow seed, never own a vineyard, never plant a vineyard, don't drink wine. What, I think he knew what he was doing when he said that. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
To all of his descendants, yes.
And that's why God did not give Jonadab a dynasty.
Right. That's why he's not king. Because as I asked you a few minutes back, Jehu did a mediocre job. He was mediocre at best. He did a third of what he was supposed to do. Well, Jehonadab was far, far better. He could have probably cleaned the whole mess up and wouldn't even thought twice about it.
He doesn't want to own land.
Exactly.
Doesn't want to rule
exactly.
And he doesn't want to have
exactly. He doesn't want to be in charge of any of that. Everything he stands for is to do anything that's it's completely against him. He won't do it. He's revered and looked up to, not only many, many years later, but even at his own time. Jehu, when he read across and said, "Are you with me?" And he said, "Yes, yes, I am." He was pleased with him that Jonadab even rode in his own chariot with Jehu up into Samaria. So he was a very important individual. He was respected at his time and respected 250 years later. How many of you can remember what your ancestor said 250 years ago? I know I don't. What knows? Yeah, I'm sure we all our ancestors said a few things, you know, duck when you're gonna spike your head. But for the most part, commands like that are not transferred from generation to generation. They really aren't. They were at that point. He must have been a very well respected individual. But God didn't tell Elisha or Elijah to anoint him as king. God commanded to anoint Jehu as king. Different types of men. Because Jehu, yeah, he's all about being king. Sure, I'll be in charge. I'm good with that. Jonadab knew better. That's not what he wanted. Not for him or his descendants. He would have then owned land. He would have owned vineyards. He would have owned people. He would have commanded and owned everything. He specifically said no. All of his descendants. All descendants. All children, male, female, makes a difference. Now, not for his cousins or his uncles, it's for his descendants. So we don't know how many brothers he had, that doesn't tell us, how many daughters, or how many sisters, or anything else. It's for him and his descendants that was a command given. I would suspect, since they're all called the Rechavites, that he was probably the head of his household, of his whole household there while during his life. But when he gave the order, it's probably at that time, but we're not sure all the details beyond it. But that's the point of what is going on here. So when Jehonadab shows up on the scene and he's seen with Jehu, what should the people of Baal, the worshippers and the priests and everything else, what should they have seen? What should they have realized when, okay, you have Jehu, go back to the story, we're going outside of Jeremiah, going return to 2 Kings. When Jehu has just killed a bunch of people that worship Baal and killed the, quote, representative of Baal on earth, the king, killed Baal, and Jehonadab, who was well known at his time not to worship Baal, Jonadab. Jonadab's descendants did not. They commanded and they obeyed God only. That was their term. So these two men are grouped together, and they come into Samaria and say, "Hey, Ahab only worshiped Baal a little bit. We're going to do a whole bunch." How dumb do you have to be a priest of Baal to believe that? He just murdered a whole bunch of Baal worshippers and priests in Jezreel. He's hanging out with a well-known God-worshipping individual who was feared by others, or at least revered. Jehu just killed the representative of Baal on earth, the king. And yet, the Baal worship priests believed him?
Well, maybe they thought, because of their belief, that
A new Baal coming on? that's probably it. But why would he hang out with Jehonadab?
Well, maybe they thought Oh,
that could be. Maybe they believe reason in their head that he was such an influential character that Jehonadab said, "Oh, I've erred. The error is my ways. I will not worship Baal now." To me, personally speaking, you have to be really, really dumb. But that's just my personal opinion.
That's mine too.
But I couldn't say that. So anyway, so obviously he pulls this ruse, clearly pulls it off. It just floors me that he was able to do so. Not that he was not smart, but the other people were so foolish.
Powerful
influence. Powerful influence, right. So they pull this ruse about gathering the people together. His excuse in verse 18, which Jehu gives as the reason. I'm going to erase this because I don't need all this stuff up here. An excuse in verse 18 that Jehu gives as to why, even though he killed the priests of Ahab and Jezreel and he killed the king, was because Ahab worshipped Baal just a little bit. But Jehu will worship him very much. What does that tell you? His reason for this. See, the reason I was able to defeat him is because he wasn't a really good Baal worshiper. He wasn't good enough. That's why I had to come and kill him off. Right? Right. He wasn't righteous enough in the Baal worship. So, Ahab was considered, mediocre, that this is his excuse, mediocre Baal worshiper. But I will be the true representative of Baal on earth. Believe me, trust me, that kind of thing. So Ahab was mediocre, but Jehu is real. He's the real deal. That's his excuse. That's why he was able to do all this. Yeah. That's why he killed Ahab's, quote, priests, because, they just obviously weren't teaching good enough in Jezreel. Yes, Tammy.
Well, the truth of the matter, though, is that Ahab probably was only half-hearted.
The one who
really believed in Baal was Jezebel. These people were actually her priests more than they were Ahab's.
In many ways, you're absolutely right. Yes, you're right. I'm sure that because Ahab did go back and forth a number of times. So he can stand on that lie and make it half believable because people knew that, even though he knew full well. Anyway, they should be smarter, but I guess they weren't. Anyways, that was the excuse. So Ahab just wasn't good enough. He wasn't dedicated enough, and that's why I'm able to do all this. Yes.
Oh, well, I don't know, but they probably weren't people of character anyway. So they were used to people being deceitful.
I'm sure that's probably true. I'm sure that's probably true. Although I've learned a little bit about it, I haven't gone any deeper than my surface understanding, and I don't choose to because it's not that intelligent. But they may not have been that smart to begin with. That's fair. Let's see. Verse 25. And it happened when he finished performing the elevation offering service that Jehu said the runners and the captains will kill him. He finished performing the offering. Now, what offering did he finish performing? In verse 23, the he is referred to Jehu, but also Jehonadab is with him. So both men are in the temple of a pagan god giving an offering. Now, normally, I would say clearly they're doing something they shouldn't be doing, because God strictly prohibits such things. The offering to pagan idols. Yet both men are doing so. And yet Jehonadab is considered very righteous too. So this offering, I won't say necessarily what role Jehonadab played in it, but obviously he was there. But he said to this verse 23, he said, make sure there's none among you amongst the Lord worshippers, only the ones of Baal alone are here. They also came peace offerings and elevation offerings and such. So all the men who were there in this offering in Samaria, Jehonadab and Jehu are there in the temple of Baal, this pagan altar, and they are giving an offering, and they actually complete it. So, technically speaking, they made an offering to an idol. In their ruse, they made an offering to an idol. Now, don't get me wrong, I won't hold that against them, but I find it interesting. That was a technique they chose to do. I won't hold it against them because clearly God didn't, so why should I? Right, they were doing something. So what did the offering accomplish? This is the reason why I think God didn't get angry with them.
All people involved.
Exactly. What, pretend for a moment, you were there in the temple, alright? You are not an all worshiper, but you're there anyway because you're curious what's going on. You will believe in the true God of Israel, but you're there and you're like, wow, what's going on? All these people here, what's happening? How does Jehu and Jehonadab make sure you're not there? Clothing? Your clothing is what I'm... If you believe in the true God of Israel, will you wear those garments? The garments is one task he does. What's the second task he does? Obviously, told the people, look, make sure there's nobody amongst you. So make sure, obviously, faces. We know that much. So people, if identified your face, they would obviously point you out, hey, he doesn't belong here. He gave them all, made sure they all had garments. But the offering itself. If, for some reason, you said, oh, well, sure, I'll put a garment on. Who cares? A piece of cloth, right? But if you believe in God, you will not partake of anything offered to an idol. You won't eat it. So, when he completes the offering, how did you know that you are a Baal worshiper? Not only do you have the garment, you were eating it too. Anyone who doesn't eat it, guess what? You don't belong here. Go away. So both methods were used or utilized to make sure only the priests of Baal were there. Other than, of course, Jehu and Jehonadab themselves, those two men. Yes.
Okay, so that's why it was okay for him to do it.
In that case, apparently, yeah. God didn't hold against him. So, right, he didn't eat it, he just offered it. I don't know what he ate. But that's what they did to their worship. And I'm not sure, the details of their service, I have no idea what that looked like. I don't want to know. But that's what he did. And then clearly God wasn't angry with him. He allowed it pass. What did he do then? He slaughtered them all. And turn it into a latrine, or a pooping station. Use that word. I like pooping station better. Because that's what they did. Because a latrine you can go on a wall. How smart was Jehu? Pretty good. But he only did a third of the job. Because he's one thing, his weakness. His heart wasn't in it. His heart may have been against Baal. And he knew and respected Elisha and Elijah. That was pointed out in chapter 9. And he even explains it again in chapter 10, that the words of the Lord through Elijah. He knew the men. He respected them. Did he respect what they were trying to teach? What Elijah and Elisha, what they were trying to teach the people of Israel, did he respect that? Jehu. Yeah, who's the God of Israel? What God was he worshiping? What God did he believe in? Jehu is not Jehonadab. Just because Jehonadab, who truly knows God, threw his hand in with Jehu saying, I'm with you, that does not necessarily mean that Jehu and Jehonadab think the same way. They don't. Who wanted the kingship? Jehu. Who didn't? Jehonadab. They didn't. So they are distinct men. They are in their own lives, their own rights, their own way. But Jehu was doing a task, and he did something, which we would look at first abhorrently, with Jehonadab at his side, who also would think, okay, this is abhorrent. Why would you do such a thing? They did something to truly purge and cleanse Israel. And in the last verse, it points out in verse 28, thus Jehu eliminated Baal from Israel. That's pretty impressive. Wish he'd finished it, but still pretty impressive. So what's the point of this story? The point of this chapter, or at least one of the many points of this chapter. The point of the chapter. When we come to this chapter, what do we gain from it? What do we learn from this chapter? About these men, what they did, and what God was doing with them. Well, you learn a little bit about Jehonadab, what kind of man he was. You learn a little bit about his descendants and how well they listened to him and how important that is to God. The listening. To actually listen and do what he tells you to do. It means a lot to him. And not have to repeat it over and over and over and over, and over again. God clearly loved the descendants of Jehonadab. He said, they will not lack a man forever. They'll be always secure. In spite of the fact they're in Jerusalem, which is about to be sacked by Nebuchadnezzar, completely burned and destroyed and abandoned, they won't be. They'll be preserved. That's important. That's a good thing to know about you, that you have nothing to fear. It's hard to get it. But they got it. So that they received that many, many, of course, years later than Jehu's time. So we learned that about Jehonadab. We learned that about the kind of man he was and his descendants. And what kind of people that God respected or liked. He liked people to listen to him. Did Jehu listen to him? Partially. He had partial listen. He got four generations kingship out of it. He partially listened. That was his reward. He didn't finish the job, but he got part of it done. He wiped out Ahab as he was commanded to do so. He even wiped out Baal, although that was not an explicit command, though it was implied because Ahab brought Baal in. So he wiped out Baal. He did not finish the job with the other parts. So it's not so much as contrast of two men in one way. One that one listens completely and one listens mostly. It's what you do and how you hear God's voice and what he tells you to do. What you do with it. Jehonadab obviously did something great with it. He preserved his entire descendants forever. Jehu did something mediocre with it. He got four generations out of it. It tells you how important God considers you listening or us listening to his words. It means a lot to him. Just listen to it. Any questions or comments? Yes.
And also he desires wholeheartedness.
He does. Because Jehu clearly was a failure in verse 31, is it 32? It explains that his heart was not in it. David's heart was, and God respected David as a result, because his heart was truly in it. Jonadab's heart was, and respected him accordingly. God cares about that. Any other questions or comments? I like Jonadab. He's a great man. I think he's wonderful, in my opinion. To me, there are other details with this chapter which I'm not getting into because I'm kept you forever in a day. But it's useful to me to learn what God respects in men and what he does not. What he cares about, what he values. If he doesn't change, that means what he respected and liked then, he still respects and likes now. Make sense? Thank you for your time. Have a good rest of your Shabbat.